Welcome to the Thursday, June 11th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules. And we have two members excused, so we're awaiting our third member, but we will convene as a subcommittee for the purpose of, we have our third member. Okay, forget that. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2020. And Erin, would you tell us about this one?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2020 alters definition of public official. It prohibits governor, first partner, secretary of state, state treasurer, attorney general, and commissioner of Bureau of Labor Industries from receiving money or other consideration for speaking engagement or presentation. Requires deputy secretary of state, first partner, and all policy advisors and attorneys employed by governor's office to file a statement of economic interest. Increases civil penalty for willful abuse of official position by public official. This measure does have an emergency clause. It does come to you with no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact, and with the unanimous support of your House.
Okay, welcome, Governor Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, Kate Brown, serving as Oregon governor. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of you on House Bill 2020. It addresses four main issues. First, the bill alters the definition of public official. This bill recognized that the person who is the governor's partner, the first lady, or the first gentleman serves in a public role. Toward this end, the bill makes clear that the first partner is statutorily defined position. With this statutory recognition, there can be no mistaking the duties and responsibilities of the first partner that come with holding public office. Now, I've certainly received a number of questions about how to define the first partner in a way that reflects modern day relationships. Obviously, the spouse or the domestic partner of the governor would serve as the first lady or first gentleman. The bill allows for monikers to be used. In my personal example, it's Dan the First Man, DTFM, for those who are counting. History's shown that sometimes our personal relationships don't fit neatly into statutory construction. So this bill specifically authorized the Ethics Commission by rule to determine when an individual who, quote, primarily has a personal relationship, quote, with the governor should appropriately assume the role. Second, the bill addresses who must file statements of economic interest. The bill requires the first partner to file such a statement in addition to the governor. The bill also addresses the governor's policy advisors and requires all policy advisors and the governor's legal counsel and deputy legal counsel to file an SEI as well. The statements of economic interest serve the public in an important way. They disclose certain financial interests of influential public officials. It's imperative that the governor and the governor's office be a model. And this piece, frankly, is a clarification of the statute. Third, following through on a promise I made the day I took office, the bill codifies a prohibition on accepting money or other consideration for any speaking engagement or presentation given while in office. The bill goes a step further and applies this prohibition not only to the governor and the first partner, but also to the four other statewide elected officials, including the Secretary of State, the Treasurer, the Attorney General, and the Labor Commissioner. These statewide elected positions are full-time positions. Using these public platforms to solicit private speaking fees is quite simply unacceptable. Finally, House Bill 2020 increases the amount of civil penalty that may be imposed for the willful abuse of official position by a public official. This use of office provision is truly the cornerstone of Oregon's government ethics philosophy. The notion that the public trust may not be used for personal financial gain. When this tenet of our ethics laws has been violated in an egregious and willful way, the Ethics Commission should be able to impose a larger penalty. By and large, most public officials are doing good work and are certainly not trying to run afoul of ethics laws. However, when the public trust has been violated in a willful way, we need the tools to hold that particular person accountable. In closing, I understand all too well that law changes can occur in a knee-jerk reaction to bad actors. The ethics package and House Bill 2020 specifically offers measured, thoughtful, and needed changes to ethics laws, changes we can make today to make the future better, regardless of the unfortunate circumstances from which they arise. Thank you so much for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you for bringing this to us and for your testimony. Do we have any questions?
I really have a question. I just have an observation and a statement. You know, if the legislature passes a law and when the governor, you notice I said when, because I'm in favor of this, I'm fine. When the governor signs this, the real test is if we enforce it. That's the key here. I mean, I think, unfortunately, in the legislature are aware of a vast array of circumstances in which the question and the eyebrows are raised is, okay, we had some laws that may have prevented this particular set of circumstances and other things, but if we don't enforce those laws, it does no good to tell the reporters here and the press that, oh, we passed this law and we have it covered. It's the enforcement piece, or the failure of enforcement piece, for whatever reason, that really creates the loss of trust for the public.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, I agree.
Thank you, Madam Governor, and I'm a yes vote.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. And I'm assuming, since the bill has an emergency clause and will take effect upon signing, that we might expect to see the first partner or Dan, the first man, at the signing ceremony.
Oh, Madam Chair, I think he avoids this building as much as possible. So unless you specifically request that he be there, I think he would rather be out biking in the hills of Salem. So
Consider it officially requested.
Not to be nonpartisan or bipartisan, if he wants to bike, he is a smart individual. Notice I said individual, not man or woman, for not wanting to be in this building. Especially by the time you sign this.
Okay, thank you very
thank
much,
you.
Governor Brown. And I don't think we have anyone else wishing to testify on this bill. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2020, open a work session on House Bill 2020, and our vice chair is not with us today, so
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2020 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2020 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion?
I just happen to notice that it's 2020, like 2020 vision.
2020, vision. Right.
Yeah, so
it's
we
a good
to be
number.
Able to see straight on this one for now.
Okay, any objection to the motion? Motion carries, and since I'm a chief sponsor, I guess I'll assign it to myself to carry on the floor, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 2020. And let's just
away, but so why don't we just go ahead and maybe
move to 35-30. Okay. We'll jump around a little bit, and I will next open a work session on House Bill 3530B. Erin, would you tell us about this one?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3530B prohibits specified terms imposed on vision care provider by vision care insurance or vision care discount card. This measure has no revenue, minimal fiscal impact. This does come to you from the Senate Healthcare Committee, and then was referred to you by the before it got voted on the floor. It is our intent to send it back to the floor with an unamended bill.
Okay, thank you, Erin. I believe there was a full public hearing and an amendment was adopted in the Health Committee, and the bill was sent unanimously with a due pass. So I don't think we have anything further to do with it, but just send it back out again. Senator Boquist, would you like to make a motion?
Thank you, Madam. I move House Bill. It was amended in the other committee, so it's
Would it be due pass as amended?
It's just a due pass. We're
just due pass.
Our recommendation today is just a due pass.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3530 to the floor with a due pass.
Okay. Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 3530 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Cruz was set to originally carry this bill.
Senator Cruz is the person to carry it.
Okay, we will ask Senator Cruz then to continue to be the carrier, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 3530. And shall we go back?
She's on her way here, so we'll go to this one next and just wait for Representative Nathan to begin.
I think Representative Nathanson is on her way to testify on her bill, so we will just stand at ease for a moment and waiting her arrival. Oh, Zoe?
There we go.
Okay, committee will come back to order. And I'll open a work session on House Bill 2375A. And Erin, would you tell us about this one?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2375A requires state contracting agency to use template and contract form developed by the Attorney General and Department of Administrative Services as basis for public procurement and contracts. It allows exception for unique procurements if agency receives approval from the Attorney General or the Department of Administrative Services, requires person conducting procurements for state agency to complete training or have professional experience, requires Department of Administrative Service to establish training and establish requirements, directs Secretary of State and State Treasurer to develop and use forms and templates, and establish training and experience standards for own staff conducting procurements or administering public contracts, requires Department of Administrative Services to develop recommendations for promoting best practices and report to Legislative Assembly by November 30th of 2015. Measure becomes operative January 1st, 2016. There is an emergency clause on the measure. We have a dash A11 amendment. It permits the state contracting agency, in accordance with the public contracting code, to negotiate terms and conditions of contract form or template, but may only vary from terms and conditions with advice of Attorney General or legal counsel if state contracting agency anticipates form or template will result in public contract price that exceeds $150,000. Requires Secretary of State and State Treasurer to establish standards for education and training to conduct procurement or administer a public contract not later than December 31st of 2017. Requires person that conducts procurement or administers public contract for the Secretary of State or Treasurer to meet established standards by December 31st, 2016. You having no revenue, and a fiscal statement was issued on the dash A11 amendments.
Okay, and I see we've been joined by the chief sponsor of the bill, Representative Nathanson. Would you like to come forward and tell us about your bill? Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. This bill had a smooth ride through the House, but there were questions raised and concerns at the Senate Business and Transportation Committee about the underlying intent for the bill and exactly how it would be implemented. We worked hard over the last few weeks with representatives of organizations or even with their clients to satisfy a few very specific issues. We now have the clarifying amendment that has been explained by the committee administrator. We developed that amendment with vendor representatives or their attorneys, and in part, those amendments or the amendment language was developed even with those persons working directly with the bill drafter. The committee administrator has explained it. I want to highlight a few things for the record. One of the topics was risk. There was concern raised during the hearing about risk involved in public contracting and how this bill addressed the topic of risk. First, I want to emphasize that this bill is about the process of developing and managing contracts. It is not about the content of those contracts. The content is negotiated on topics such as scope, deliverables, price, and sometimes warranties. I have been assured by the drafter that the intent of the bill, as I intended it and as it was drafted by the bill drafter, and the language of the bill itself, nothing about it changes anything about the current allocation of risk. Nevertheless, in order to clarify this, we did make a couple of changes. On page 2, lines 26 through 36 of the A engrossed bill, the paragraph discusses when a contract form or template should be used. In line 33, the word significant has been changed to unreasonable, since there was concern over the use of the word significant. A similar change has been made on page 5 of the A engrossed bill in line 18 when referring to DAS's duty to promote best practices in public contracting. The phrase, quote, reducing risks and inefficiencies has been changed to the phrase, quote, managing risks, reducing inefficiencies. Another question raised during the hearing was whether the state agency could still negotiate the contract while using a standard form or template. I want to make it very clear on the record and with interested parties listening in, some are in the room, others may just be listening online, the ability for state agencies to negotiate terms and conditions is a fundamental principle of and covered in the public contracting code. This bill does not change that. in order to make it equally clear in the bill itself, the language in lines 5 through 11 of the dash A11 amendment ensures this ability to negotiate. And three, finally, to address comments regarding the pace of change in the private sector, particularly in the world of IT or information technology. The state does engage the IT vendor community in the public contracting process, and Oregon has received recognition and awards from the National Association of State Chief Information Officers and the National Association of State Procurement Officials for our open work group concept, where DAS and Department of Justice already host a collaborative task force to discuss and vet standard forms or standard terms and conditions for use in IT contracting. Just recently, for example, DAS and DOJ hosted open work groups to revise IT contracts to accommodate recent developments in software, such as software as a service and cloud computing. So they're working with the vendor community and recognizing that there is indeed a fast-changing world out there. This past March, both Tech America and ITAPS, who did have comments at the public hearing, were invited to participate with DAS in a panel presentation at the NASPO conference in front of 44 other states, plus dozens of representatives from other major IT companies. I am very pleased that we were able to reach an agreement on the language and to address and reduce concerns of all those who spoke at that public hearing. I hope the committee will consider this Dash A11 amendment as a sign of the level of support for the bill. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for all your work on this, Representative Nathanson. I know you've done a lot of work on public contracting in previous sessions, too, so I appreciate your spending the time on this. Do we have any questions for Representative Nathanson?
No. Anything that will help us avoid IT debacles like Cover Oregon, I'm in favor of.
Okay. Thank you for your comment, and thank you, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you.
We do need Senator Burdick.
Guns and pot, we can have Burdick back more often.
Right. Okay, we are in a work session, and Senator Boquist, would you like to move the Dash A11?
Yes, ma'am. I move the Dash A11s into House Bill 2375.
Senator Boquist has moved the Dash A11 amendment to House Bill 2375. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Senator Boquist.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2375 as amended by the Dash 11s to the floor with the two pass.
Okay, Senator Boquist has moved House Bill 2375 as amended by the Dash A11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? Motion carries. And there's no Senate sponsor on this bill, so perhaps we could ask Senator Beyer, since it originated in his committee, to be our carrier. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2375A. And that just leaves one more bill, so I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2176A. Erin?
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2176A removes requirement that person elected to county office provide county clerk with certificate of election, requires electronic filing of candidates' nominating petition or declaration of candidacy for primary election, changes certain ballot markings from presidential only to federal only, alters certain filing deadlines, adds prospective petitions requirement that full text and measure be circulated by signature gatherers and available for review, removes requirement that signature sheets for initiative or referral petition be attached to full and correct copy of measure, requires Secretary of State to establish process for modifying petition templates, requires that one copy of prospective initiative and referral petition be sent to required officials rather than two copies, permits district attorney to make clerical corrections to ballot title for district measure, requires all estimates, portraits, statements, and arguments for voters' pamphlet to be filed electronically, makes candidate statement for voters' pamphlet subject to prohibition on and penalties for false publication, requires that district attorneys, district elections authority, include ballot title for district election on measure at the time the measure is submitted to county elections official, provides person to whom civil penalty may be imposed ability to request hearing 20 days from service date of, on notice, direct secretary to provide and allow electors, chief petitioners, and other agents to use electronic signature sheets to collect signatures for prospective initiative petition, requires Secretary of State to verify signatures in certain instances where county clerks currently verify signatures. There is an emergency clause on the measure. You have an A4 amendment, Madam Chair. The A4 amendment removes reference to, quote, excess of any amount of necessary to defray expenditures regarding use of contributions by campaign committees to resolve account debt. Correct statutory reference to House Bill 2177 so that July 1, 2015 is established as date for determination of total number of registered voters in Oregon for purposes of maintaining status as minor political party for 2016 general election as intended by the measure. The dash A4 amendment has no revenue, minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, and I do see that we have folks from the Elections Division here, and I think there may be some questions for you, so if you'd like to come forward.
She's going to abandon it from the back of the room. Look at that there.
Okay.
Fails right under the bus here.
And Senator Boquist, I'll just throw it to you because I think you do have.
I have questions if you're ready to answer. I wasn't aware of the A4 amendment, so I apologize for that. I'm looking at sections 3s and 4s, and I apologize that you may not have got the email version of this, so you know it, but I'm trying to deconflict the intent of motor voter, which has passed, with section 3 and 4, which now allows people to opt out of certain voting things. So I'm just trying to figure out what we're trying to accomplish, since we just wanted everybody to vote, and now we want to have everybody to have the option to opt out of either the state or the federal ballot.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brenda Bays. I'm the Deputy Director for the State Elections Division. Section 3 and 4 is regarding someone who moves to the state after the voter registration cutoff deadline, who left their state prior to having the ability to vote for a presidential ballot. Those individuals can vote for president in Oregon if they complete the form that says they did not vote for president in the other state. Currently, this is another ballot style for county elections officials to create. All this does is allow them to use one of the current ballot styles that has only federal candidates listed on it, mm-hmm. and they can use that ballot to vote for that presidential vote.
Follow up.
So, because I got to explain this to 11 other people who aren't in this room. So what I think I hear you saying is person A moves from Wyoming to here. There are some requirement things because they just moved into the state that they're able to vote, so on and so forth. And I think what you're then saying is that because we have presidential only ballots versus local ballots, you know, the difference between HAVA and all those sorts of things, that the county would have on hand a form, a standard form, in the county clerk's office, so that individual could vote through that ballot. Is that what you're saying? And it's limited to only those people, not the entire population.
Senator Broquist, it's a ballot. It's a federal only ballot,
right.
And only those individuals would be able to vote that ballot for president only.
Thank you, Philip. I'm sure.
Yes, go ahead.
Section 27, and I do understand in theory this is a cleanup, but there's nothing that's a cleanup bill in this building. Section, I guess, 27, if I, my thing is upside down here, so let me find the right one. Section 27 provides that the false statements made by candidates and any submissions to the state voters' pamphlets for appointing a candidate, and it kind of expands and clarifies this. What section are we talking about in the filings? And since we have problems now, why does this fix anything in the future?
Madam Chair.
I believe you know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, currently there is a mechanism in the statutes that says that if there is a false statement in a measure argument,
right,
an individual could go to circuit court and file,
right,
a court case. There is also in 260.715 of Oregon election law that says you cannot make a false statement under the required information.
Right.
The only required information in the candidate's statement is occupation, occupational background, at the top of the educational background, and prior governmental experience. The bottom portion of a candidate voter pamphlet statement, the optional information,
right,
there is not a mechanism for someone to file if there's a false statement in that area of the voter's pamphlet.
Yes, go ahead.
And so this still allows the bottom half, which is the, I'll just say for a better word, propaganda statement that they're putting in, paying you to put in the deal. That allows a candidate to say whatever they are want to say in there, as long as it doesn't violate another law. And it's the required information in the top half of the form that remains to be, or has to be truthful. Am I correct in making that statement?
Senator Boquist, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I think, as you well are aware of, there's another division in the Secretary of State called the Corporate Division. And I have a problem with the whole section because the Secretary of State hasn't been able to make a determination, for example, occupation or other categories that are in there that are placed in the top half. The Secretary of State even looks to the other division, the Corporate Division, and says, well, we can't agree or disagree whether this person works for Company X or Company Y, even though Company X or Company Y isn't registered for us and it's required to do so. So I'm not sure why I'm at a loss of, if we can't make the first determination, why we have this or the expansion, and I'm not sure you have an answer for me, but I think that's problematic.
So, Senator Boquist, if I could clarify, this would provide an avenue for someone to go to circuit court if they believe there's a false statement in the bottom portion of the candidate statement.
I'm in the top portion. I mean, and when the Corporate Division says this company Y doesn't exist, but it's filed over on the election side, and then the Secretary of State's office says, well, oh, well, we can't make, you know, we can't decide whether it's a real company or not. You're the agency, the Secretary of State, who's supposed to make whether it's real or not. Now, we both know, and everybody else knows, that unfortunately, the former Secretary of the State, I had this discussion years ago, is that this company, you ought to be able to enforce it, but there is no enforcement mechanism. So what I'm saying is there's no enforcement mechanism for Section 27 in here to start with. But I have a question for, I guess, Section 33. In Section 33, for whatever reason, we, the legislature, did it. All three of us were here when we did this. We kind of moved treasures in, treasures out, so on and so forth like this. But the question on Section 33 I'm trying to figure out the intent, because one would think that we use the term, I gotta make sure I have the right term there, we use the term controlled, who controls a committee in terms of a committee, and that is either A, the candidate in some cases, B, the treasurer, which we assume, and as we know, unfortunately, whatever, many of our treasurers are just professional staff, you know, rented people, or three, the alternate filer. Now, in order to be the alternate filer to file a check, you have to be on the checking account. So my question is are we adding the treasurer in addition to the candidate, and why aren't we adding the alternate filer, since the alternate filer, as you know, in your electronic system, if the alternate files, you know exactly who filed and said check X or expense Y did what. So why are we adding the treasurer and not the alternate filer? And, of course, I don't know why we voted to take the treasurer out the first time, but that's not yours. So,
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, currently in election law, the candidate is the responsible party if a transaction is filed late or insufficient in the ORSTAR system.
Right.
A political committee, it is the treasurer, and that is what we're clarifying, that in a political committee, the treasurer is liable. The treasurer is not liable in a candidate committee. It is the candidate.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
Okay. So then why isn't the alternate filer liable for a transaction that they filed that either is false or unable to confirm to the Secretary of State?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, the current process is the candidate for the candidate committee and the treasurer for the political committee.
Well, Madam Chair. So what you're really saying is that it's a political decision of the legislature or a policy decision of the legislature of whether the alternate filer who can sign checks, who can do everything the treasurer is, ought to be added to Section 33. Is that what I'm – you have no position, correct?
That's correct. I have no position.
Okay, thank you.
Could I just follow up on your question before you go on to another section? So who is the responsible party currently for political committees and petition committees?
Madam Chair, currently it's the treasurer because that is the only individual that files the transactions.
It is the treasurer.
It is.
Well, then what does this change?
It adds the word It clarifies in the statute that it is treasurer because it is not currently clarified in statute.
But it doesn't really change anything, it sounds
That's
like.
Correct.
Okay. Okay.
And follow up just for clarification, we took treasurer out. We did some cleanup a couple
we
years ago.
We deleted the reference to the treasurer, so we're really just correcting
Yeah, we didn't.
That.
It was one of those Scrivener bills, LLC, uh-huh. said treasurers okay. are all going out from another committee.
Okay.
But the point is, Madam Chair, so what I was driving at in terms of the treasurer piece is you have a political committee and now a treasurer is the one responsible. We're putting mm-hmm. that back in.
Right.
But you can also have the alternate filer who is on the checking account, could have signed the check, done it, and in Orstar done the filing. The treasurer is completely clueless, doesn't even know where the filing is, and then when they're asked at a later date, say, okay, where did these, and I'll be specific, so, and I can explain to you mm-hmm. later, but where are these 8 or 10 checks? The treasurer goes, I don't know, mm-hmm. because I didn't write them. They were done by the alternate filer, and of course, there is no recourse to the alternate filer to determine what happened with those. No way to find the money. I won't go into that detail right now, but she does know what the issue. So that's mm-hmm. the problem. You have these alternate filers. You know, and in many times, if you're a large organization, you know, the alternate filer may be doing as many filings as the treasurer. The other problem that could be problematic in this is that, again, what we're doing is holding your Mr. Neely or our, I'm thinking of a name here, our Ms. Butler, okay, one of these professional companies who serve as the treasurers, they're being held accountable because, and they're the professional person that, you know, one political side or the other political side or one position hired to do this, they're now held accountable for it, and the directors who may have told them to do X, Y, and Z are scot-free. But generally, an alternate filer is, in fact, a member of that committee. That's the reason I have issue with this, is that somebody needs to be held accountable, and somebody needs to be able to, the Secretary of State needs to have the authority to reach out to somebody and say, hey, you did it, tell us what you did it with it. Because we have a situation, an expanding situation, not on your side, on our side. Hmm. Screwed up Republicans, but that's okay.
Okay.
And so that was the point there. I do have a question in terms of Section 37 and understanding and clarifying independent expenditures. The chair and I discussed previously, not in here, but to set the context, is that independent expenditures, of course, aren't done in Orstar and aren't done on 7-day reportings and things like that, to my knowledge. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Boquist, independent expenditures are filed electronically now in Orstar.
In Orstar.
That's correct.
And what is the reporting time frame for that?
Once they have 7 days to report the independent expenditure.
And just for my clarification, actually, I think I do remember, we're changing laws here. So what is the threshold and the background for an independent expenditure?
Senator Boquist, it's $750.
So if an entity exceeds $750, that time they have to file and then they go into the normal reporting process?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Good change. I agree with that section. The only comment I had, and I had sent was, again, the interesting thing on Section 39, which I wholeheartedly agree, if you're an ORSTAR, filing electronically means that. But I know from at least personal experience, and I believe this is correct, that the alternate filer receives, generally if it's a candidate committee, the candidate, the alternate filer, and the treasurer all receive a copy of, hey, you did bad, or whatever it is that's going out. And that really goes back to my question of, I'm assuming the alternate filer would find out now that policy would continue under this, but they might not be held accountable for something they did.
Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Thank you. I appreciate the answers. I do believe, Madam Chair, that, you know, if you're going to have a committee and you have an alternate filer and they have access to the bank account, which is almost 90% of the case, then they can do the filing. They can, you know, leave the treasurer high and dry, and then the state at this point doesn't seem to have a mechanism to go back and find out what happened. And these are real-world examples in which there's missing funds and missing money, and it appears that nobody has the authority to figure out what happened.
And just to be clear, the treasurer or the candidate has to designate somebody else to be able to have the authority to file these documents?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Uh-huh. So presumably,
there's no accountability.
The treasurer has made that choice, or if it's a candidate committee, the candidate has made the choice to designate that individual.
Right, and in our case, we can hold the candidate accountable, but it's over on the political committee side. You can have the poor treasurer, in many cases, we'll just say, I'll pick on a Republican, and I'm trying to be deal of county, of the county of Jefferson, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there is a county of Jefferson. I was trying to pick something. County of Enterprise. Mm-hmm. So the county of Enterprise treasurer for the Republican Party, that person, how they get authorized to do that is in the minutes. They have to submit the minutes within 10 days to the Secretary of State, and they're automatically then liable because they got elected to that position. It's the alternate filer that is not held accountable any place in the state code, and so that alternate filer may in fact be the chair of the Enterprise County Party, and they make these transactions, and then there's no correct recourse left, and you come out of balance, and there's missing money, and then there's no recourse left for the Secretary of State to go back and figure out what transpired or where the money went or where the money was spent, so on and so forth. And in my mind, if you simply add the alternate transaction filer in here, because we know if the alternate person, if Aaron's the alternate and I'm the filer and Aaron files, it electronically knows. The election division knows exactly who, what time, everything else that individual actually filed. It's just they're not held accountable if they went out and spent money in the middle of election in violation of the law. And they're kind of held scot-free. A technical fix would technically fix this, Madam Chair. And I have a no vote at this point.
Yeah.
So
I hear what you're saying. Okay. So, Brenda, to address that, we would have to designate these designees as responsible parties in addition to the treasurer and the candidate, is that right?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And what happens currently if there's somebody else designated by the treasurer, the candidate, who sounds like you're talking about absconds with funds or?
No, madam, we don't know what happened.
Uh-huh.
We just know the money is missing.
But, so money disappears, some other person has been designated to handle those funds, is you still would go after the treasurer and?
Madam Chair, it would be the treasurer of record of the time of the transaction that occurred.
Which, Madam Chair, just to complicate this more, how screwed up the law is that, I remember I mentioned that there's minutes. So if the county chair and the county treasurer of Enterprise County are, they don't run for re-election at the normal organization meeting. When the organization meeting happens, there's a new county chair and a new treasurer elected. It is the new county chair under the law and the new treasurer that have to file with the county clerk within 10 days and do the changes with the Secretary of State. However, if they fail to do that or they don't do that for 6 or 8 months, it is still the old people who are blamed and held accountable because the new people didn't follow the law. But since they haven't filed it, the Secretary of State is left in limbo land because there's no enforcement. So you got old treasurers and old Secretary of States being blamed for actions that they weren't even on the bank account for, or they weren't even involved in. But there's no mechanism, there's a gap in the law. It seems to be a rather simple fix, you would think.
Okay, well, did you have any other questions for
no,
the Secretary
ma'am.
Of State's office? Okay, well, thank you for your clarifications. And I don't see any other questions, so I think for today we'll just close our public hearing on House Bill 2176. And that completes our bills for today. So with nothing further to come before us, members, we're adjourned. Thank you. Adjourned. Thank you. So with nothing further to come before us, members, we're